Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Tuesday, April 28th. I'm Ray Graff. It's the Copyright Forum today. Do you have a big idea? Something that's going to make you a lot of money? Yeah, me either, but other people do. And if you want to save that, you're going to want to call in today. It's the Copyright Forum. We have our experts. Paul Rapp, Polly Law, and Bill Westwood are here to help you protect your writing, your music, your art. If you have a question about copyright law, fair use, what's in the public domain, feel free. 800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. You can email voxpop@wamc.org, voxpop@wamc.org, or 800-348-2551. Paul, Polly, Bill, copyrights after the news. Well, hello. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. It's the Copyright Forum today, and we've assembled a great panel to answer your questions. Polly Law is past president of the Graphic Artists Guild, an organization focused on the rights of artists. She's a designer, illustrator, and artist herself. Bill Westwood is one of the country's leading medical illustrators, a professional member, and past president of the Association of Medical Illustrators. And Paul Rapp is an intellectual property lawyer and writer. He represents musicians, writers, fine artists, businesses involved in the creative economy. He's a frequent lecturer, as you'll soon hear. The number is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also email the program at voxpop@wamc.org if you want to protect your intellectual property, and we all do. Welcome, panel. How are you?
Hey, good, Ray.
Kind of noncommittal. Bill didn't answer, and you were like, not that good.
I was trying to get a sip of water here. I'm doing great.
Good. It's great to have you all here, and at least you sound enthusiastic. Polly Law, you have a show coming up. Let's just chat about that for a moment. What's happening?
Okay. Thanks, Ray. I have an exhibit of my what's called Papier Collé work coming up. It's a duo, what they call a duo solo show at Albert Shahinian Fine Art. It opens to the public on the 9th, but then the opening reception is on the 16th.
Is this your work here?
The one on the left, yeah.
Very lovely, lovely work. And you're doing this with Travis Jeffrey.
Yeah, and he's a collage artist.
This is great. Okay, so this is...
Rhinebeck, New York.
Rhinebeck.
May 9th through July 26th. Exciting
yes.
stuff. Obsessions with parts and pieces. What parts are you obsessed with?
Well, the work I do breaks things down basically into separate little units and then reassembles them.
Yeah.
Got any livers in there?
No, I haven't done any interior work, as they say.
Interior work. Bill Westwood is an interior worker. And, you know, yesterday we did it's a tough show to do, but it's about, you know, abdominal cancers and pancreas and things like that. You ever do a pancreas? You ever draw a pancreas?
Many times.
Yeah?
Yep.
Diabetes is big business.
Well, everything from diabetes to tumors to...
Yeah. Pancreas insufficiency? Did you do that one?
I don't recall. But
see, I learned some things on the show.
I've done many types of pancreas illustrations.
Well, that's exciting. Paul Rapp, what is happening with you, my man?
I'm just keeping my head up and enjoying the changing of the seasons.
Really?
Yeah.
What do you like best about it?
Warmth.
Yeah. Yeah, being able to sit out, being able to put the top down.
It's a bad tick season, man. You better watch yourself. Yeah. Wear socks and whatnot if you're out there. All right. Well, we've exhausted the chit-chat. Let's get down to business. Pop artist Robert Indiana, late. A dead fellow,
yes.
Yeah?
Yes.
Involved in some copyright news. Bill, please explain.
Well, I think most people, if we could see it, a picture of it, would recognize the love statue that Robert Indiana created.
In Philly.
Many years ago, and his former agent has just won a $102 million verdict in a Manhattan federal court against another entity it accused of exploiting his work and forging thousands of works and selling them for millions of dollars.
Wow.
So it's an interesting case you don't usually see single image type copyright lawsuits that are settling or getting verdicts for $102 million.
This is the iconic Love.
Yes. I love New York. I love.
Okay, yes. So here's the deal.
No, it's the L and then the
I Love New York.
The O is
what's his name? The designer. The
Milton.
Milton.
Milton Glaser.
Yes. Thank you.
Sorry.
Okay. Who was the defendant in the case?
The defendant in the case was...
Was it a bunch of...
American Image Art, art publisher American Image Art, and its founder, Michael McKenzie, must pay the Morgan Art Foundation, which apparently is the foundation that controls... Robert Indiana's work, for interfering with contracts and violating its rights in Indiana's works, including his iconic Love image.
What are the odds of that the plaintiff collects the full amount? I mean, don't you just declare bankruptcy and call it a wash?
Paul might be able to answer that better, but I would say that that in all likelihood, American Image Art possibly has some kind of insurance. I don't know much about them, but you know, it might be a fairly large organization.
Forgeries are always just interesting cases. You know, I mean, it's just, and they're using AI now to detect forgeries.
Now, let the record show that most of the time when I bring up AI, the people on this panel sort of get a little tense. And now the lawyer brought up AI first here at 2:13.
What a difference a year makes. Last year I was saying I was pretending it didn't exist.
Yeah.
But and, it seems to me that this is more a matter of plagiarism than forgery, because...
No, they were copying
right
his images and selling them.
And putting his signature on it.
And putting his signature on it.
That's forgery.
That's forgery. Oh, okay. But it wasn't...
But the fact that they were selling them, they were making copies and selling them.
Yeah, authentic.
I think that's the key to the copyright.
But selling them as authentic Robert Indiana sanctioned.
Yeah, I'm sure it was more complicated than this is giving us if you looked into. Because I think this was going on for a little while. I don't think it was a slam dunk.
Okay.
And then there's also been instances where they have a painting that they don't, you know, it's an old painting, like from the Grand Master period, and they can't figure out, you know, they can't authenticate it. AI now is capable of doing
that. The Grand Master period was what, 350 years ago?
Yeah, but there's plenty of paintings out there that don't have any attribution to them.
But the copyright's gone, right?
It's not.
Oh, yeah.
It's valuation.
Yeah, it's the value.
I see. The number here is 800-348-2551, and we will get to the calls here after the first break in a couple of minutes. It's Paul Rapp, Polly Law, and Bill Westwood. Yes, here at the tail end of a mediocre career. Cheryl, oh boy. Cheryl writes in, I am writing something in which I would like to include multiple quotations regarding my particular topic. If I use a grammatical quotation mark around the statement and include the author's name, do I have to get permission from each author to use their quote? That's the first question.
That depends. It depends how long the quote is. It depends... You know, how you're using the quote. I review a lot of self-published books, you know, that people send to me to make sure there's no legal problems.
Yeah.
And song lyrics always come up. And my rule of thumb is if you just use a song lyric like window dressing, you know, at the beginning of a chapter, you've got some, you know, then you probably should go get permission. If it's part of the narrative of the story, you know, you walk into a bar and you hear, you know, busted flat in Baton Rouge, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
Waiting for a train. Then that's part of the narrative, and that's allowable.
I see.
If you do a quote and talk about the quote, then it becomes fair use, a matter of fair use.
So if you're writing a nonfiction book about what a brilliant line that is, you're all set.
Mm-hmm.
A second question from Cheryl. What about anonymous quotes? Can they be used without permission from where they were read or heard?
If they're anonymous.
Yeah, if they're truly anonymous, or if you're just saying, "Gee, I don't know who said that."
Yeah, there's no there. I mean, I've had books where they put in a quote, and then I go, I stick the quote online. I do a Google search.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, websites of famous quotes and where they yeah. have thousands of thousands. I'm like, go ahead, you know, if it's out there, you know, on that basis. But if, you know, if you use more than a couple of sentences of something and you don't have any justification for it other than you want to pretty up your book, then you probably ought to go get permission.
All right. This is from Sandra. Attended a family wedding, took a video. Does the music played at the event or the music added to the video need to be identified by artist? Thank you. We'll listen to the answer recorded. So you're not listening now. All right, Sandra, this one's for you. It's a long-distance dedication. What do we got?
If you're going to post it on YouTube, you're probably going to have a problem. Identifying it isn't really a problem, but especially like YouTube, they have bots that go around, and if they detect music that, you know, the owner has said they want protected,
yeah,
they'll whip out, they'll, you know, cancel the sound.
So Oasis can't play anything on YouTube because it's that derivative?
You and I agree on that.
Okay, fair enough.
But yeah, I mean, if you're just going to do it and have a video that you're going to show your friends on your phone or whatever, that's fine.
But if say they have a video that is basically soundless, and then they put a music, they should identify the musician, and don't a lot of the video services have.
Identifying doesn't really accomplish anything. It's not a get out of jail card free.
Like Facebook and stuff, they recommend certain music tracks, and I assume those are pre-cleared.
Yeah, the pre-cleared ones, and then they probably, as part of the standards for yeah. using it, they want you to get, give it a provenance.
It.
Yeah.
You know, let me ask the other two here. Aren't lawyers a real pain?
I was just going to say it's more complicated than it should be. It's really stupid.
I work with lawyers all the time. So
you like them?
I have great lawyer clients. What can I
tell
you?
What about you, Polly?
I have several lawyer collectors, so.
You know what? This is a tough room. Let's take a break. 800-348-2551. We'll get to the phones in a moment. Paul Rapp, Bill Westwood, Polly Law, the Copyright Forum. We'll be back. Ah, lovely. Tony Levin and Stickman there. That's ringtone here on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551 is the number. Polly Law is here. Bill Westwood is here. Paul Rapp is here. And it's you on the phone at 800-348-2551 here on the Copyright Forum. We begin in Newburgh. Stuart, you're on. Go ahead.
Oh, hi. So I have a question regarding a digital piece of art that's in the Whitney Biennial. And the way it worked is there was a sign on one of the balconies, and you download an app, and then the app has these images that are drawings by the artist that you can then place in the landscape, and then you can take a picture with your phone, and it will place the artist's image in the landscape on your phone. And it just occurred to me, like, what are the rights? Could I print that out and put it on my wall? I mean, there's no information about the rights, and, you know, I'm just kind of curious about that. They were encouraging social media interaction, and honestly, I don't really do that. So, anyway, what are your thoughts?
Well, usually that kind of a presentation is so low resolution that you would not be able to print out anything worth printing out. But even then, it may be that thumbing a nose at copyright is part of the artist's intention here.
Yeah. Are these contemporary artists, contemporary pieces?
Yeah, they're very contemporary, and the images are vector images, so they're scalable. So you'd get a pretty high quality printout, I think, if you printed it out.
Yeah, I think if you printed it out and hung it on your wall, you know, that would be okay. If you printed it out and then made 1,000 of them and started to sell them,
right,
that would be beyond the pale.
Yeah, you can't sell somebody else's work. I was just surprised not to see anything or have anything. I mean, it's kind of a cool piece. I like the piece.
Yeah.
But
how would you copy Well, you could copyright the digital portion of it, but you could not copyright the image of that digital portion superimposed on your landscape, because each person would produce a different work.
Oh,
but he's also not asking about copyrightability, is he?
Well, he's asking about how could they enforce a copyright
or
on the piece when there's no copyright notice?
If it wasn't copyrightable,
yeah,
it's unenforceable.
If you take a picture of somebody's home and it's only the home, my understanding is that you need rights, you need permission to publish that picture.
No.
Whereas if you take a picture of the home and you step back and it's in context, then you can publish it.
No, if you take a photograph from a publicly accessible place, it's going to be okay. And a home's not going to be protected. People aren't going to be protected if they're out in a public
place. On their own property.
Yeah. On their own property, sure. But if you're standing on the sidewalk and you shoot a picture...
That's unacceptable. Let me tell you something else.
You're going to have to start wearing clothes, Ray.
No. Don't fence me in. All right. Stuart, if you finish up, and then I'm going to go on a mini rant. Go ahead.
It's an interesting question. I don't have anything more, but thank you for addressing that.
That was an interesting one, man.
Yeah. You got it. Okay, so go ahead, Bill.
But let me just ask one question. Paul,
yes.
Wouldn't the fact that they were giving people permission to do that be looked upon by the courts as some type of license?
Yeah, if they're encouraging you to take a photograph.
Right.
What are you supposed to do with? Yeah, I absolutely agree.
Okay. Yeah.
Which is why I said, you could probably print one out and hang it on your wall. But if you print 100 and try to sell them, I don't know what would happen.
But couldn't the argument?
You got a point on that, Polly.
Couldn't the argument be made though that permission was granted to use this?
Tacit.
Implied. Yeah.
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 All right. Well,
rant, Ray.
No, you wrecked my flow. I'm not going to rant now. I'll save it for another time. Let's go to Chris in Bradford, Connecticut. Chris, you're on.
Howdy, and thank you all. There's this thing that my wife found. It's something that covers the television set, a piece of art.
Mm-hmm.
And it will roll up, mm-hmm. so you can watch your TV and roll down.
Cool.
when you want to hide the TV.
I like it.
And she showed one of her pieces of work to use, and they liked it, and asked her for more, and offered kind of a deal where they would give her $80. For every time somebody wanted to use one of her pieces of work.
That's a pretty good deal.
Pieces of art.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's like...
Well, how many people are going to want to do it, Chris? You're not going to make $1 million, right?
She's not. No, I don't think so, but...
I would still register that artwork right away.
I would register the copyright to the artwork because your wife will retain the copyrights. They just are getting a license to reproduce it, but your wife is still going to continue to own the copyright.
So that's not work for hire?
Nope. Unless there's a contract that says work for hire, it's not going to be work for hire. And
have they given her any paperwork to agree to?
No, that's just it. Yeah, that's just it. How do you register, for instance?
Well, you register the original artwork.
Yeah, you at copyright.gov. And
copyright.gov.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that's the protection that's the most protection you can have. So if the license stops and they keep printing it, you can get them. If you see the art popping up somewhere else cuz somebody bought the TV screen thing and copied it, you can go after them.
You might also, in my opinion, speak to a copyright attorney to help you negotiate this. Look, suppose the thing takes off and suddenly it's selling thousands of pieces a year. I would think you would want to negotiate a deal that would give you some flexibility if they start making a lot of money, that you can participate in that.
Yeah, so you get more than $80 a pop.
Yeah, that's the whole value of copyright, is that the artist is able to benefit from highly successful pieces.
Yeah, I mean, publishing deals are the same way. I mean, if they sell 500, it'll be $80. Over that, it'll be then $90. If it's, you know, over 1,000, you know. I mean, you can structure the deal any way you want, but I think you want to talk to somebody who's knowledgeable about these kind of contracts before
you
sign
anything.
Right,
you want some professional guidance here.
But you need to register it first.
Yeah, right away.
All right, Chris.
Okay, well, thank you all very much. And the thing is, you know, flattery goes a long way with people.
Oh, yeah.
Hey, tell me, I've been enduring that for 53 years. I understand.
Well, hang on, Chris, thanks a lot. What kind of flattery are you going to do? You're in a medical illustrator.
Clients call you up and say,
I've ever seen.
I love your work. Yes. It's so perfect. It's so great. I really want to license something. I want you to create something for me. Well, by the way, I don't have a budget right now, but, you know, we were wondering if you could make a deal for us. Then we'll come back to you in the future.
It's the exposure, Bill.
Yeah, exposure.
Bite, bite, bite. I bit on that so many times in my early years. Never once.
You're
never
all
once.
Very cynical people.
As I say, you can die from exposure.
That's correct.
Okay. The number here is 800-348-2551. It's the Copyright Forum. I had my doubts, but we're off to a fine start now. Let's go to Todd in Bristol, Maine, is it? Todd, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I happen to be traveling back from Kentucky to Bristol, and I stumbled upon your show, and I was hoping I could help, or you could help discuss maybe a particular subject that some artists might need to learn.
Go ahead, Todd.
My wife happens to be a relatively well-known equestrian artist. She features the equine world. She travels quite a bit to horse shows. And she has successfully defended herself 3 separate times over the last 20 years, settling out of court under copyright infringement law. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that many people, I think, need to learn is the difference between inspiration and source.
Mm-hmm.
She happens to create, her name is Sarah Richards, she happens to create watercolors, two-dimensional pieces that get copied quite a bit. And we've received the expensive education through lawyers' fees. and again, we've won every time, but it doesn't change the fact that it's an expensive endeavor. And I was hoping you could just discuss the difference between source and inspiration those that think they're coming up with something unique.
Good idea, Todd. What do you think, folks?
Well, it's always been a problem because you need to be able to justify, you need to be able to show your...
Go ahead.
To show your inspiration, say. Well, on the piece, the postcard that I gave you with the piece from my upcoming show.
Yeah.
That's a 2-spot bumblebee, and I had to do some research on it online, and then I looked at the photographs and kind of studied them and tried to note what was special about it, and then I put the photographs away and I did my drawing.
Mm.
That's one way to not, you know, not transpose a photograph.
Yes, putting the photographs away is key.
Is
the key.
Well, how are you going to prove that?
If you keep it out and stare at it. Well,
you're too good at it, what if you have a photographic memory?
Well, then you got a problem.
Well, then you shouldn't be an artist. You should be with the FBI or something.
It's be a card counter
in
Vegas.
You guys are talking about fine art. When it comes to commercial illustration, all of those things are fair game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, the bottom line is if I create something, if I put something on paper, that is copyrightable, that is registerable as mine. And by the way, to the caller, you need to, if you run into this again, I assume your wife is from the sound of it registering these pieces. But if a piece is registered prior to infringement, you can search around. You can find an attorney who will do work on a contingency. And the contingency might be 35% of the final reward if there's no case actually filed, a complaint filed. And if a complaint is filed, it can go up to about 45%. This is a way to stay ahead of the costs.
Yeah. Equine art is really interesting too. I mean, there were owners of famous horses, or people would do a painting of the famous horse, and they would sue, saying, "We own the horse," and you know, but that's something that's rooted in the right of privacy. And I've never met a horse with an appreciable sense of a need for privacy.
Well, you don't know.
You know?
And Dr. Doolittle? What do you know?
And the other thing is there's only so many ways you can draw a horse. And so is someone claiming... I mean, it sounds like in your cases that it was just like literally copying the work altogether.
Yes, and, it was.
Well, so people have been copying your wife's work. Is that what the main question is? Or is she taking photographs herself?
Let me try to describe. My wife is incredibly creative, and she creates paintings right out of her head. She looks at horse pictures all day long, but when mm-hmm. it comes time to create, she just sits down and creates.
Right.
And on three separate instances, other companies have taken the image and made things like underwear and clothing drinkware with her image on it. Now, again, we have defended ourselves successfully because it's not like it's something that was somewhat like my wife's art. It's actually art.
So that's
clear. By the way, by the way, if you ever want to get a half a dozen lawyers to be quiet, you take a photograph of your art and print it on a transparency, mm-hmm. and then lay that transparency on top of their product mm-hmm. to see every single line match up identically.
I've done that.
And then they're suddenly happy to take you out to dinner and talk about a settlement.
Yeah, I've used that technique several times.
Yeah.
All right. Well, yeah. Todd.
I just find it interesting that artists actually need to understand, and you described it accurately, the difference between source and inspiration.
Yes.
When you go to create something, you can't have an image or anything within sight that you are thinking about creating. It has to be from memory. It has to be in a different room. It can't be a tracing. It can't be a projection. It can't be I'll look at this for 5 minutes and then look at my paper for 5 minutes and draw and then look back for 5 minutes. It can't be within sight. Otherwise, you are crossing that definition of source versus inspiration.
Well, Todd, thank you very much for the call. I got to say, I find this, if I was an attorney, and thank God for all of you that I am not, but that would be a tough one to prove. It would be very tough to prove.
I have to disagree with what he's saying. I think there might be some merit in it, but I don't think you have to look at a source and put it away.
And hide it. Yeah, I mean,
I use reference material all the time, even if it's...
You're doing technical illustration.
Well, it's very creative.
You need to follow.
No, if you do conceptual work, you're not trying to. There are different types of work. If you're illustrating for a surgeon who's putting a piece in a surgical textbook, it has to be really accurate. Okay. If I'm doing a conceptual piece for a magazine cover,
mm-hmm.
it can be highly conceptual and totally off the wall.
Yeah,
but there might be some element in that I need to refer to.
Yeah, well, it's like portraits. If you want to do a portrait of a famous person,
you've got to work from that person.
You can't take one photograph and paint that. That's a derivative work. You get four or five photographs of that person, and use them all as sources, and create something new.
Bill, have you ever done a magazine? Cadaver Digest? I mean, have you done a magazine cover? What magazine?
I've done hundreds of magazines.
But medical illustrations?
Yeah. American Family Physician, Contemporary.
So journals?
Yeah.
Cadaver Digest.
I don't know. Let's grab one more call.
You've never heard of that?
No,
The Cadaver Journal?
I used to subscribe.
The Cadaver Journal?
Yeah. Deliver quarterly. But Tom, you're on. Go ahead.
Oh, am I on?
Yep. Yes. Go ahead.
Hello.
Yeah. Hello.
Yeah. I got. We had a drawing done at a fair of one of our relatives, and we wanted to use that as a part of an invitation. And the artist's name is on it, And we're not going to make any money or anything. It's just sending out to 20, 30 people to go to a party. Is that, like, okay?
Here we go with my lawyerly advice. It's probably infringement, but just do it anyways.
Yeah.
You know?
As long as it's that small a bit of circulation.
If the guy wrote a memoir and you put that on the cover of the book, that would be a problem.
Yeah.
But something more modest, like you're talking 20 or 30 invitations, you know. I mean, I don't think the artist would object.
And the off chance he found out about it. It's not like we printed them either. They were just emailed out.
Well, yeah. If you wanted to be super, super, super safe, if you know who the guy is, just contact him and ask for permission.
Oh, yeah.
Tell him what you want to do. That's always the safest thing.
Okay.
Okay. All right. Appreciate it.
You got it. All right. Thanks a lot for the call. We'll take a break. 800-348-2551. Bill Westwood, Polly Law, Paul Rep. Everybody's apparently tired of the show. They're sighing. I understand. There's no, 20 minutes left. We'll make it. Well, Ray Charles classic there, done by John Scofield. Let's Go Get Stoned here on Vox Pop, the copyright forum. Hey, that's the name of the song. 800-348-2551. And before we get back to the phones, we'll do a couple emails. Before we do that, though, and let's keep it brief. You say you can't work from a photograph if you're painting, right, or drawing or whatever, right? And then somebody else says, well, you have to use multiple photographs. Is there a minimum limit of how many photos? If I'm doing a picture of a famous person, a painting, do I have to have 3 photographs? 4, 7, 9? I mean, it's very vague.
Do you remember the case that involved, what's her name?
Shepherd Fairey?
No. Cat. The copying of the photograph as a tattoo.
No.
Oh, yeah.
Which is, by the way, being, it may, the decision may be reversed.
It's still out there?
Yep.
Wow.
I meant to bring that along, and I didn't. But anyway, it all depends, Ray. The reason you use multiple sources like that is so, you know, photographer Smith can't accuse you of infringing his or her work.
But a person's a person. There are only so many angles.
Doesn't matter. Because a photograph by a professional photographer in particular is going to be unique in terms of its lighting. It's going to be
style.
Unique in terms of the photographer's style, because photographers have styles like illustrators and artists. And so if I'm looking at that and that's, you know, a reproduction of that exact photo, I got grounds to sue.
But will you win?
If the work is registered, you might or might not. The case we're talking about, the photographer lost initially, but it's been appealed, and it will probably come back and be reversed.
Okay. Let's see here. This is from CM. An example, please, of the satisfactory demonstration of when the infringement, quote, should have been observed or discovered, end quote, in order to successfully use the statute of limitations as a defense. In other words, the statute defeats the cause of action because the infringement should have been discovered. Because?
Yeah, I mean, that comes up a lot. I've had that in a number of cases where, you know, my client found out about some infringement, you know, 5 or 6 years after the infringement occurred.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're not allowed to have your head in the sand. But then again, somebody saying, well, that's been on the internet for 6 years. You're under no duty to, like, police the internet to make sure that it's not on there. So, it has to be reasonable, but there's no.
But it also depends on when you discover it. I've got a case, going to have a case right now that I just discovered Friday that goes back 10 years. You know, I'm going to pursue that. And I've done other cases before where I've gone back that far and sometimes farther, because the statute starts tolling when I discover it. Now, part of the defense might be, oh, you should have discovered this. But the reality is, not everything pops up. Even when you use image search, not everything will pop up on the internet.
Yeah. But and that's a hard thing to show, that that you waited too long, you know.
Now,
that you didn't discover it when you said you discovered
The statute of limitations, once it begins, is 3 years. So you've got 3 years.
From the time of discovery.
From the time of discovery.
How many lawsuits do you do a year? You're always talking about lawsuits.
I've done 37 altogether.
In your life? Or this year?
In the last 15 years.
That's amazing. That's incredible. Your lawyers must love you, man.
I've had a bunch of them, including Paul.
Yeah.
All right, this is from John. I have a registered trademark and a logo for my business. I noticed that the Coca-Cola logo has a name, the Dynamic Ribbon, if I remember correctly. I have a name for my logo, and I'm wondering if there's a way to make it official. What do you think? That's from Farmer John.
Huh. Just start using the name. I mean, it's like the Nike swoosh or the dynamic. I mean, you can give it a name, and if it's clever enough, you could probably trademark the name for the symbol. Dynamic ribbon, maybe swoosh, you can. I mean, Nike has trademarked the word swoosh, which describes the little thing on the side of the sneakers. So,
All right, Frank in Rhinebeck. Okay, so Polly, you're the painter, and you're going to have to help me because I'll mispronounce this French painter's name. Frank writes, I'm an artist. I was commissioned by Jean-Michel Basquiat
Basquiat.
Yeah, whatever. In 1983, to paint two small paintings for him. He paid me for my paintings. 40 years later, at a
Basquiat
exhibit, I saw the image of one of my commissioned paintings embedded into his painting. His painting was also a collaboration with Andy Warhol. Do I have a claim for a portion of this painting if it sells? I have visual art proof that it was my particular commissioned painting incorporated into the
Basquiat
Warhol painting.
Wow.
Whoa.
Maybe.
Well, that's you could consider it to be, I mean, Basquiat paid for it. So he owns it. He may not own the rights to it, but he owns the physical art.
Yeah.
But we're talking about something that was prior to 1978.
And he has collaged it into his
If he actually used the actual painting and cut it
embedded
up and put it on the secondary canvas, then that would be okay. And this was when in 1976?
1983, Frank was commissioned.
Okay.
Okay.
So
it's within the current.
After the
I think you'd have to investigate it a little, but it's worth investigating.
It's worth talking to a good copyright attorney.
Yeah.
But and then the issue is do you collect from Basquiat's estate? You can't collect anything from the current owner of the painting, right?
No.
I believe it's Basquiat, by the way.
Basquiat.
Mm-hmm. Got to get that right.
Yeah. Jean-Michel.
Yeah.
I think it's worth pursuing.
Okay.
But, you know, who knows?
Go ahead.
Excuse me, though. Wouldn't you want to register that work right away before you start pursuing this? You can't. If it were to come down to a copyright suit, you can't sue without a registration.
But it was commissioned, and that...
Well...
I mean, if there was a document listing the commission...
If it were commissioned, though,
Without
a rights transfer.
Yeah.
But this person was paid for it, right?
Yeah.
Isn't that an implicit work for hire? I'm paying you to do something.
You have to specifically say a work made for hire.
And... both parties have to sign off on that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Congress actually made a law to protect artists, believe it or not.
I'm shocked, I tell you. Shocked.
Yeah.
All right, one more email here, and then we're going to jump back to the phones. 800-348-2551. Copyrights today with Polly Law, Bill Westwood, at Paul Rapp. Glenn writes in, I hope we can answer this quickly. What are the panel's views on the Anthropic copyright infringement lawsuit where AI companies are accused of pirating certain authors' books to teach their large language models? We can't go all day on this.
Okay.
So,
I mean, Anthropic lost and they paid and now a bunch of authors, you know, opted out of the settlement. And I'm seeing all these ads for, you know, you can get $150,000 because they used your book. And you're not going to get $150,000. I think in the settlement they got... 3,000 each, something like that. You know, and it's like they copied it, they scanned it and used it as a teaching tool. Whether it's even infringement is a question, but this shows you how much money these companies have. Anthropic just said, okay, we'll settle. You know,
yeah, it's chump change.
Yeah.
But I have high hopes that all the lawsuits are eventually, and maybe the government, God forbid, would recognize that the scraping of people's work is in fact an infringement.
Yeah.
But that's
hours worth
of discussion.
I have a counter argument, but you know what? I think you've all had enough of me, so let's go back to the phones. Dennis in Westfield, Mass. Dennis, you're on.
Thank you. Yes, good afternoon. Hopefully this won't be as complicated as some of the questions so far.
I'll give it a shot.
I travel around and have for decades doing lectures and demonstrations, historic demonstrations, at various historical societies and museums and libraries. And it's in my contract that videotaping and reproduction, yada, 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 is not permitted. But more and more lately, I've had people prop their cell phones up on their knee, tape my entire presentation, and then within a couple of days, it's up on YouTube or Facebook under their name, which I find annoying, but also it means that other places don't hire me to come out and do the programs for them. And I've confronted them, or I know that's probably too strong of a word, and I've been told, since you did this at an event at which the public was invited, you gave up all rights to it.
No.
No.
I didn't think so.
You can contact YouTube and complain, and they'll take it down.
Well, what I would recommend is that you start registering those presentations. And then you've got grounds to sue these people.
If he follows the same script, he doesn't have to register each presentation.
Well,
I don't follow this. Everyone is slightly different, but it's geared towards whatever the audience.
But even with the forthcoming price increases, if there's a cost to copyright or to register something.
I understand.
Honestly, I think you're passing up a lot of potential money going after these infringers.
Yeah, me too.
So I would go to the expense of registering those. If you see somebody out there doing it, register that right away. And then don't you confront them. Get in touch with a copyright attorney and have them write them a letter and demand money.
Could that be a serial copyright since it's the same topic each time?
I don't know.
But you know, sir. I mean, have you gone to YouTube and done a strike?
I have not. No.
Yeah,
that's just recently.
Yeah, I mean, because it'll come down immediately if you do that.
Okay, I didn't realize that. I'll try that. Yeah, I just had somebody contact me that wanted more information because they saw one of my lectures on YouTube. I said, "What one was that?" And I said, "I don't ever remember." And they said, "Oh yeah, I just pulled it up." It's like, oh man, here's another one. I thought I had caught them, you know, but
Yeah, but I mean, it's one thing to get it stricken, all right? It's another thing to make money from it.
Yeah.
I mean, come on.
Right.
You can do both.
Yeah.
All right. Well, good luck, and I appreciate the call. 800-348-2551. Dean is in New Marlborough, Massachusetts. Dean, go ahead. Oh, boy. Hello, Dean.
Hi, how are you?
Go ahead.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah.
There it is. Thanks for having me on. My original question pertains to, actually it's more of a statement, pertains to patent law. I have a patent that I received many, many years ago. It's long since expired. But back in the day when I was making this item, it's a part of a musical instrument holder, there was another major company that started copying what I was doing, and they avoided any kind of lawsuit by changing a particular screw or a way it attached to work around the patent that I had, and they were able to put this item out on the market. Subsequently, they sold many more than I did. I made my money back on the patent itself, and I'm happy with that, and that's all well and done. And, 20 years later, that the ones that I've manufactured are still out there and the competition is still out there. But there's major companies like that that have more at their disposal can get around the patents to create something. Initially, mine was when I applied the first time, my lawyers came back and said, well, after doing a search, it's in conflict with this patent for a folding dish rack. And so by changing something in the way it was styled, and they reworded the patent, resubmitted it, I got the patent. Now, they've changed, you know, this major manufacturer changed something in the way it was put together, and now they have their patent. And it doesn't conflict with mine because it's made in a different way. It's not an item that I would ever have made $1 million on. However, and as I've said before, I'm very proud that I got the patent, and life goes on.
Right.
But it's just sort of a warning that these things, intellectual property law bends in many directions.
Yeah. Yeah, and patents can be really gnarly.
Yeah, I've been down that road with a patent, and my co-patenter and myself were convinced we had a multi-million dollar item. And it was very hard to get a licensing deal from the major companies we needed to get them from. Patents are a tough, tough road.
Paul?
Yeah, and I attempted to work with the major company to see if they would allow me to manufacture for them. They didn't want any part of it because they can do it in China for a lot less than I can do it here in the States.
Of course they can. Yep.
And they could, the other thing is, an American patent does not cover you in Europe. So you have to apply over there if you want. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, they can just flood the market over there. They can give it away, and nobody pays for it, but the market's now flooded.
Yeah. All right. Well, Dean, thanks a lot. Paul, you want to add anything on that? All right. Very quickly, we have about a minute and a half. We'll go to Lee in Pittsfield. Hello, Lee. You're on.
Hello. Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have talked to Paul Rapp about this once. I just recently got a book deal to publish some of my performance photographs. And before I had talked to Paul about selling prints, but I wanted to know if these are of pretty well-known performers, and I wanted to know, do I have to get permissions or pay them anything to publish a book of photographs that they may be included in?
Did you have authorized camera passes to get into the
and
the venues?
Some of them, but not all of them.
Yeah. I think you're going to be all right to put them in a book.
It's a public place, right?
Public place, but sometimes they'll put restrictions on the attendees. But I'd have to look at it. But people do these books all the time, and so you could probably sell prints, but they should be limited editions and not mass produced.
Like fine art prints.
Yeah, yeah.
But this is different because it's a book and it goes back 50 years.
Okay.
Covering a lot of turf.
The Music
everywhere
Inn.
From Tanglewood.
The Music Inn.
Yes, Music Inn. It started there.
Well, Lee, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. We are out of time. Count Basie's about to play, and there he is, tinkling the ivories. Paul Rapp, if people want to get in touch with you, how do they do it?
My email is paul@paulrapp.com.
And Poly Law, the new art thing, looks fantastic. It goes May 9th to July 26th.
Yep.
How do people find out more?
You can contact me through ArtWordsT on Instagram.
Bill Westwood, when it's time for you to paint that goiter of mine, how do we find it? How do we find you?
Just contact me via westwood@capital.net.
You guys are the best. Thank you for being here. That was a good one. Support comes from Ballet Flowers and Design, Malta, New York, a family-owned garden center and flowering. Start again. Ballet Flowers and Design, Malta, New York, a family-owned garden center and flower farm offering landscape, wedding design services, perennials, annuals, herbs, and interactive classes. BalletFlowers.com. at Bonham and Douglas Architects, an architecture and interior design studio designing retail buildings like River Valley Co-op in East Hampton, Massachusetts, bd-arc.com. All right, bit of a struggle, but got through it. Thanks again to Bill Westwood, Polly Law, and Paul Rapp for being here. Thanks for listening. Thanks to Mike Bowen at the controls, Ed Rosenscreen the calls. Tomorrow, Tony Yang is back. We'll help you work through your computer and tech woes. If your modem is acting up, just call us. We'll see you, too.